This morning, as we conclude our lesson, we want to make a few more points about persecution. We were talking about persecution in our last class, and we went down to our eighth point that we want to make. The purpose of persecution, whether it's political or religious or economic, is to try to make people afraid or to be intimidated so as to not continue whatever they are doing. And that being the case, persecution, of course, arose against the Christians because they were seen originally as a cult of Judaism. Then later, as they rose in power, they were seen as a brand new world religion, which they have become. And we want to make the point this morning that pressure came from all sides. When you ask what the motivations are for persecution, there are all kinds of reasons, five of which I've listed here for you that we have from the scriptures. By the mid-60s A.D., period that Paul and Peter finished their lives, Christians were beginning to face increasing harassment and persecution for a variety of reasons, which we'll mention these five quickly here. A, religious. There was religious persecution. In Acts 17:5, we learn that the Jews were moved with envy. The Pharisees, the Sadducees were envious of Jesus and what the power of his popularity and growth, as well as what he was preaching and teaching, which was adverse to what they were teaching. The Sadducees denied the resurrection. They denied the man's immortal soul. They didn't like that. So they were envious of him. That was a religious motivation. There was political motivation. In Acts 17:7, we learn that Christians were acting contrary to Caesar. They were contrary to Caesar because they believed in God. Of course, they were mistaken. They weren't really against Caesar because Caesar was a mark of government, and Jesus even told his disciples to pray for your government, not to pray for their paganism or their culture, but to pray for their leadership and guidance. And that being the case then, because they seemed to be going contrary to the Christians, then there was a political motivation. There's economic prejudice as well, or persecution. Acts 19:27, a text to which Reuben was referring this morning, merchants began to complain, Demetrius the silversmith, and I'm sure others, that our craft is in danger. That is, our craft of making idols and these little amulets, whatever they were producing, was in danger because of the teaching of the gospel, and therefore there was also economic persecution in that sense. And maybe a big one is a psychological, and for lack of a better term, psychological persecution. 1 Peter 4:4 tells us, and essentially I'm paraphrasing these verses, that when you changed your ways, when you became Christians, the people who were your former friends with whom you lived ungodly lives, they then stop and say, wait, what are you doing now? You've changed, you're no longer drinking, you're no longer engaging in promiscuous sex, you're no longer worshiping idols, what's going on there? They didn't like that. Whenever people are with you as your associates and there's a change in your behavior, they don't like it, either because it guilts them, makes them feel guilty of what they're doing, or you're just not going along with them, you're going along with the crowd. And as that's, I would call that a psychological persecution, the idea you no longer run with them. And when you don't run with the people with whom you used to run, they stop and ask why, and they try to intimidate you by making you like you're weird, you're strange. We call that peer pressure, another way to put it, sociologically or socially. And there was also a broader societal persecution. The apostles have turned the world upside down, we're told in Acts 17:6. They're preaching a gospel that we said last time revolutionized the whole world of ethics. Jesus taught the idea that in order to be great, you must be low on the totem pole. You must serve all others, where the world thinks that we should be on the top. Whereas the world teaches that you hate your enemies and you treat them with the same thing they treat you, Jesus said, no, you love them. These were revolutionary ideas in ethics that were so from the beginning, because that's God's ethic, but it came down into a pagan world. And so as a result of that, this inverted world, this topsy-turvy world where the apostles are preaching something that's so strange and odd, that would bring about a kind of societal pressure or persecution. And as a result of that, one historian then writes and remarks, their neighbors, that is Christians' neighbors, got suspicious because these church members seem not to care about the well-being of the city if they were not willing to worship the God that protected them. This goes back to kind of a social or sociological persecution that other people begin to realize, wait a minute, we have a God, a false God, well, they didn't call it. We have a pagan god who protects our city, whether it was Jupiter or Neptune, it wouldn't matter who it was. And you are going against that god now and going to your god, and therefore there was kind of a pressure put on that people were suspicious. Like, who is this strange god you're worshiping? It's not one of the Greek or Roman gods. And that brought about a pressure that even the people began to maybe, you know, react in different ways to them. Consequently, many did not interact with them. They begin to isolate these Christians, make them all pariahs, which would then explain or elucidate the words of Peter when he says in 1 Peter 3:4-12 from the New English Bible, "You have had time enough in the past to do all the things that men want to do in the pagan world. Then you lived in license and debauchery and drunkenness and the forbidden worships of idols. Now, when you no longer plunge with them into all this reckless dissipation, they cannot understand it." Like, what happened to you? What changed in you? And they don't understand it, and they will vilify you accordingly. When people see that you're not going along with them, the way to intimidate is to call you names, to make you feel, again, to isolate you, to treat you as a pariah, like you're an outsider now. And that, of course, that's meant to kind of make you change your mind. The whole purpose of peer pressure is to make you conform to those people, and you're not doing that, and they don't understand that. Something strange has happened to you. Yeah, it's called the gospel of Jesus Christ. Beloved, and then Peter concludes that section, beloved. In other words, he's trying to reassure them, think it not strange. In other words, don't worry about it. Don't worry about these indictments of your behavior that you are strange or weird. Don't worry about that. Concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you. The fiery trial just means not just physical persecution, but all the types of persecution brought on you. They're going to pressure and pressure you. Don't worry about that. That's to be expected because you have changed. And because they don't understand that change, doesn't matter. You've changed for the better. And as though some strange thing has happened to you. Don't worry about it, because it is strange in the sense to those people around you, but it's not strange to God. It's what God expects. And keep living your godly lives. Hopefully you'll have a positive influence on them, and maybe they will come over to the Lord eventually. We move along now to talk about the end of Roman persecution. We're compressing quite a bit of history, of course. We want to talk about the end of it, and I also want to get to my concluding points later on. The end of Roman persecution. That should be antagonistic. I forgot my IC. We think of all Roman emperors as antagonistic to Christianity. That wasn't true. There actually were 4, 5, or 6, maybe more, what we call good emperors. When you go back, there were about 81 or 82 emperors altogether, from 27 BC with the advent of Augustus Caesar and down to the very final emperor in 476 AD. There's a long list. Most of them were inconsequential, serving very quick times. But of all the major emperors along the way, there were a number of them. There were at least 5 I've read of. There might have been more who were actually called good emperors. That is, they were not persecuting Christians. And they actually had either a sympathy or an endorsement of Christianity. Galerius, 305 to 311, as we move along in history, shortly before his death, he died of cancer, we're told, he actually ordered an end to persecution. No one knows exactly why, because you often ask, why do these emperors change? We don't know, but what information we do have, and the inferences we can make, is that some believe, according to history, that right before his death, he began to harbor doubts about his rejection of God. Like, well, maybe I'm wrong, you know, kind of like the idea of just hedging his bets there, and therefore that might have explained his change. We don't know. But for whatever reason, he actually officially ended and ordered the end of persecution. So no matter what his motive was, that was good for Christians, of course, to kind of let up on the pedal, so to speak, of persecution and slow it down. And finally, of course, the great Constantine the Great. He's called the Great because he was very consequential during his reign. Between 306 and 337, Constantine was the emperor you may have heard about before if you read world history, who actually began to sympathize with Christianity. He actually began to harbor good feelings about Christianity. And then in 313 AD, a very important mark in Roman history and world history, is that the Roman Empire, by Constantine's the Great's edict, actually officially made Christianity the religion of Rome. And you think, wow, what a change from a complete pagan all the way to someone who endorsed it. Well, again, we don't know exactly why he did it, what the problem was. But historians say that he believed, from history, he believed himself that God had chosen him, the Jehovah God, the God of the Jews and the Christians, that God had chosen him through some kind of providential measure to be the Roman emperor that would end that would endorse Christianity. And that, so he believed that. Barry Strauss, in a book I just finished reading not too long ago, professor of history, observes this about the emperor, about Constantine. He says he changed Christianity from a minority religion, which it was, to the dominant cultural force of the Western world. Christianity was growing and growing, as Reuben pointed out so well this morning, but to give kind of a secular or a pagan endorsement, it makes it even better. So it's not just that God and Christ and the apostles are expounding the gospel and you know, endorsing it for us to obey and saying obey this, but you have a major world figure that is the Christian, the pagan emperor, constantly coming out and endorsing, making it legal, making it the official language of the Roman Empire. That didn't mean he was making everybody become a Christian. Of course, you can't do that. But he was making it so it's not only legal now, but it's officially a Christian empire in that sense. And so he made it, he was a cultural force there. The question a person may ask, which I certainly asked when I was studying this material, I went back and did some digging on it, why the conversion? Well, the why doesn't matter. It's the fact that he did it is all that matters. He cleared the way for Christians. That's true. But if you ever wonder, you know, you have questions about things, as I always do, I'll give you three possible influences that may be the case. Helena, or if you want to say Helena, say Helena, his mother, we are told from historical records, is believed to have taught him about the Bible when he was very young. And whether that stayed with him as Timothy from his mother and grandmother, whatever the case, that then those seeds might have been planted in such a way that along the way he began to think more about that. We don't know. So that's a possibility. Again, the influence of a powerful, loving mother and her son. We're told also he had a dream. When he was on one of his battle campaigns, he had a dream, this is by his own admission, where Jesus appeared to him in this dream and said, "You're going into battle, Constantine," because he was originally in the military, "and to win this battle, I can give you the assurance. If you'll put the Christian sign, CHR, which is for Chi and Rho in Greek, which is the first two letters of Christos, and that became a symbol for Christianity. If you ever see a little X with like a P through it, that's Chi and Rho, the two letters. It's a symbol of Christianity, just like the fish became a symbol. He said, put that on your banners, you go into battle, and you will win. Now, that's what he believed. We're not saying that's what actually happened. That's what he claimed. But whatever the reason, he's had that dream and was so convicted by the truth of it that he thought, you know, Jesus has appeared to me. Kind of like, you know, Christ on the road to Damascus with Paul, kind of like that. That's what he claims. And again, it doesn't matter whether he did or not. It moved him to then start to change his ways. And of course, the cynics would then say, well, you know, the reason he really changed, he had an ulterior motive of political expediency. He thought maybe it'd be better for him as an emperor to endorse Christianity. Well, you know, that's cynicism, and we don't know. But the point I'm making, well, no matter what, we don't have to know the motives for the change. In any event, this change boded well for Christians in the empire, because now Christianity was no longer illegal, but above that, it was actually endorsed as the official language of the empire, and that was good news for Christians in the Roman Empire. Now, concluding that section on persecution as we move along here, I want to talk about our very last topic in the book, which is morality. We've already talked about morality in certain situations in our past studies, but we want to talk about it as an influence in culture. I save this for last because one of the most important characteristics of any culture is its morality or lack thereof. Morality can be good or bad. You can have good or bad morals. But morality usually connotes the idea or denotes the idea that, you know, people are trying to do the right thing. And so we close this study by considering morality as a primary characteristic of any culture. We've looked at philosophy and history and language and religion as components of the influence of a forming a society, but morality is very important because no matter whether you're rich or poor, uneducated or ignorant, high standing, low, it doesn't matter. Human beings have to have a standard of conduct of some kind or another. And whether it's from God or their own, which we'll talk about, there has to be some kind of standard. Otherwise, you have chaos. If we were all going around doing all the things we wanted to do independently of all the others, it would be moral chaos. We can't do that. I think even atheists realize that. So we have to have some kind of code of morality. So as I say here, without a standard of, and morality is based on the idea of right and wrong behavior. That's the definition. When you talk about having morals, it's deciding what is right and wrong to do in a certain situation. Not what I feel and not what I believe, but what is right or wrong, which implies some kind of a standard. And as we're going to show, if the standard is simply yourself, that's going to be kind of faulty. You need something that's independent and permanent and stays with people. First of all, when we look at the standard of man, indeed, the first point I want to give is what we'll call the inadequacy of man. Man cannot be a standard. The best verse in the Bible for me is Jeremiah 10:23, where the prophet says, "The way of man is not in himself." That's simply a declaration by the prophet as an inspired writer saying that whatever the way is, whatever the way, and the way there means the way a person should live, which implies morality, whatever way it is that man goes forward with his life, it cannot be in himself. Can't be. It's not going to work because that will lead to moral autonomy, again, where people are doing whatever they want. One of my philosophy classes in my graduate program, I took a course called The History of Ethics, which was quite interesting because the whole course we surveyed for millennia past some of the great moral theories of major intellects in the intellectual history. Epicurus and Zeno, whom we studied earlier in this class, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Kant, and many others along the way. What they all had in common was they developed their own theory of morality. It may have taken in bits and pieces of God along the way, but the point is it was a theory that they had brought about by their own thinking. Nothing wrong with thinking, but the idea was they were trying to devise or understand some kind of a moral code that was different from, of course, the moral code by God, and they came up with these ideas. My observation from that class and other studies I did in the same area is that men generate their ethical theories from their own minds and motives, which is all they have. And so we're getting to a point now where either man sets his moral theories, which come from his own imagination and mind, and no matter what his intentions are, no matter how pure and sincere he or she might be, it's still his own idea as opposed to something else. And of course, that something else is an independent, eternal standard that comes from the God himself. And so God's morality for us issues from the one who made us. Humans do not make themselves. They are made by God. And therefore, you go then to the one who didn't make us. Of course, if you're an atheist, you deny that and you're back to your moral autonomy. But if you really believe that God is our maker, you go back to him. God not only made us and knows us better than we know ourselves, but he gave the human blueprint, the blueprint of who and what we are. Psychologically, sociologically, philosophically, theological, whatever we are of God. So what better way than to go back to the master himself who made us? And so the key distinction we're making so far is this. Human morality, that is the ideas of morality that come from individuals, are based on nature, whatever man observes about himself or the world around him. That's the encompassing term for nature. Or divine morality, which is based on revelation. So something either comes from us through revelation, outside of us, independent and eternal, or we generate it ourselves. That's basically it. So every moral theory that you can get from mankind comes from his own imagination and thought and intellect. And again, no matter how sincere he might be, it's still limited to that outlook, which is finite and mortal. Or it comes from God, immortal, infinite, and eternal. And so we can revise, and this is where our past study comes in. Remember weeks ago we were talking about Protagoras, one of the early sophists, who actually said, he made a statement back in his day that's become the modern mantra of relativism, that man is the measure of all things. We turn that around, the Word of God turns it around and says, no, God is the measure of all things. Again, Jeremiah 10:23. And so I hasten to move on here. The good life. What is the good life? We talked again in our past studies about philosophy and the big questions. One of the big questions in philosophy that people ask, even if you're not a philosophy philosopher or philosophy student, doesn't matter. If you've ever pondered, how should I conduct my life? How should I live every day when I get up and go to work, go to school in my neighborhood? That's a very big question. It's one of the big questions of life we talked about earlier. So we are here for only a very brief time. Time goes so quickly, as an older man can tell you about my life. It goes quicker the older you grow. We're here for such a short time, so how are we to live while we are here? And I've already mentioned some of these, so I'll kind of speed through them. We come down to the pagan world, the world of the Greco-Roman world, godless autonomy. Godless autonomy just means simply living on your own, by your own authority. When man rejects God, the first chapter of Romans, and turns away, he has only one recourse. If you reject God and turn then to yourself, you're turning to nature. And whether you turn to yourself or somebody else, or a philosopher or nature, it doesn't matter where you turn, you're staying within the very bubble of nature. And so your morality will rise only by your own autonomy, that is how you rule yourself. And naturally a man will turn to his own ways and develop his own theories, as we spoke of earlier. Notice the close of Judges. The Bible addresses this. The Bible addresses everything, if you think about it. It's told at the very end, when we go through all the judges, the people who wanted a king there, it said in the closing chapter, Judges 20-25, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That is moral autonomy. That is when man goes out and rejects God, rejects God's judges or kings, and says, I want to live my life my own way. That's the very expression of hedonism, the idea of going out and just seeking what I want for my own pleasure and my own device. A second point I want to make is a world awash in hedonism. Hedonism is, by definition, is simply pleasure. Hedonos is the Greek word. Whenever you see the word pleasure in your New Testament, it's hedonos. We get our word hedonism. It doesn't mean going wild. People often have a misunderstanding of hedonism. Hedonism doesn't mean getting drunk and just eating until your gut's about to explode. It doesn't mean that. It means living a pleasurable life, but a secular life. That is, eat until you're full, drink until you're full, sit back and relax, intellectually, physically, you know, enjoy life itself with no recourse to God whatsoever. Because hedonism in its basic sense is, I want to get that back, I hope. Nobody back there. Well, okay, there it is. Thank you. We want to make the point, and just bear with the logic on this. If indeed there is no resurrection of Jesus Christ, there's no eternity awaiting us, and there's no hope for anything after the grave, then why pretend otherwise? So there's a logic to the moral autonomy. If you reject God and you reject the resurrection because you would reject Christ and all of that, then simply, you know, you're going to live your own life, basically. And Will Durant, very renowned historian, says in one of his works, The Life of Greece, to the Greek, the best life, this is to the Greco-Roman world, the best life is the fullest one. And by full, they mean they're rich in health, rich in strength, power, mental or physical, rich in beauty, trying to become as beautiful as you can, passion, that is enjoy your emotions and feelings, means, which means money, economics, adventure and thought. And that's the end of it. There's no reference there to God whatsoever. Simply enjoy the life right now. And so if that's the case, that there's no God, no resurrection, then it would make sense. And even Paul would agree with that. In 1 Corinthians 15, that whole the resurrection chapter, as it's called, Paul goes all the way through, and he's presenting a logical argument all the way through. If a lot of if-thens, a progression of thought, if this and this and this, being very logical, he gets to a point in 1 Corinthians 15, 32, where he actually begins to conclude, if the dead rise not, he's trying to convince all the people Jesus Christ was resurrected, believe that. That is the foundation of our faith. But he says, hypothetically, if it's true that the dead rise not, if Jesus didn't come back, then let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. We studied Epicureanism a few weeks ago. That's the very definition of Epicureanism, and as well as hedonism. And it's true, you think about it for a minute. If all our life is confined to this and there's no hereafter, then simply go out and live the way you want. Why? Because there is no moral standard. There's no spiritual standard that says otherwise. It was Jean-Paul Sartre, who a French philosopher and atheist, who actually said on one occasion, one of his works, if God does not exist, then anything goes. He was acknowledging the obvious, that if there really is no God, then we're really on our own. And so you see the consequences of a godless society. We're not saying atheists can't have morality. I'm not saying that, because there are godless people who still believe we have to have a moral code just to, you know, survive. So we understand that. But the point is, if there really is no God, then there's no Christ, there's no resurrection, there's no salvation, so do what you want. It makes perfect sense. Paul's trying to make the point. It's called a reductio ad absurdum. In an argument, when you get to a point where you contradict yourself, he's trying to make secular people contradict themselves by you know, confronting the obvious. And so that's a very good point we make there. Two more points before we go on. Constant carnality. Carnality is, of course, the flesh, living by the flesh and our desires. We showed in our world of gore, and I'll call it games and gore. Remember, we talked about gladiatorial battles and the paganism of that culture, their entertainment. People developed a deeper and deeper appetite for savagery and suffering, where human life had little value. The pagans did not give the value to the human life that God does. To the people out in the gladiatorial battle who were killing each other, animals and humans, to them, they were just thought, oh, that's just those are simply objects for our entertainment. They didn't see those as souls created by God. They didn't see those as people who were subject to the gospel of Jesus Christ. They were just, you know, biological creatures out there. And when they saw the destruction, the death, rather than thinking about God, they just thought about their own appetites and said more and more. Okay, they would be saying encore. They weren't French, but the point is they were saying more. We want more and more again. And a point we want to make here is, I will say, jaded by this parade of death, that is just totally worn out. Because there were people in Rome who were tired of seeing. Even some of the emperors didn't like it. Some of the emperors I've read about did not like it, but they was, you know, they thought it entertained the people, you know, bread and circuses, so let them do it. Even they didn't like it, but it still went on. But there were many people who became so jaded and tired and tedious of this parade of death and destruction. Many were then hungry for something more. You know, maybe there is something out there beyond us. You know, they begin to think about God. Therefore, the time was getting closer and closer for a Savior, which occurred when Jesus came. Hence our study, the fullness of the times. The time for hope. Christ then entered a world which had been studying at a preordained time. When the time came right, God decided to send forth his Son, Galatians 4:4. That was the time that God had decided and nobody else. To redeem a race that had devolved into incessant sin. Genesis 6:5 talks about the idea that man's thoughts became worse and worse and worse, and they sought out all kinds of inventions. In the King James, that means they were just looking for ways to sin. Not just being satisfied by their sins, but trying to find new ways to sin. How can we get worse and worse? For them, it was better, not worse. That's because they had totally perverted God's moral code. The time was, of course, the world was destroyed by the flood. When God's anger reached a point where he thought, that's, I've had it, he destroyed it. And he'll do it one final time with fire, and that will be it. That time is building and building and coming. So the time was right for a Savior that we came. And as Solomon writes also in Ecclesiastes 7:29, a very clear statement of what we're talking about here. God has made man upright. The Garden of Eden. God made Adam and Eve. He made man to be in his, man is in his image. He made him to be upright, to enjoy all the bliss. But of course we sinned. We, meaning humans through Adam, we sinned and brought us down. So we were created that way. But he has sought out many inventions, that is ways to sin. God made us the way we were supposed to be, his intention. We blew it. We sinned. We fell. And as a result then, God looked ahead from Genesis 3:15 on as a prophecy that someday a Messiah will come. That day was approaching and approaching and approaching, and that's what Galatians 4:4 is all about, that time would finally come. And though God allows us our free will to choose how we live, he has respect for us. Among all the intellectual properties he gave us, you know, emotions and thought, he also gave us volition or free will. He allows us to do that. We can even reject him if we want. He doesn't want us to, but we may do that if we want, because he wants our love. He doesn't want our coercion. He doesn't want to compel us. He wants us to love him, which presupposes a free will to make that choice. And therefore, he then sent forth his Son that we could love that Son and obey him, and for all those who seek salvation. And I want to make another note here about this before we go on to our concluding remarks for this class. Why does evil flourish? The critics have been asking since time immemorial, and they still do today, you know, well, if God is really a good God, a wonderful God, why doesn't he just end all the evil right now and just save all of us? And of course, they're saying these things, you know, facetiously and sarcastically. You know, how come God getting so bad? God's lost control of the world because the world's moving further and further from the grace of God, as it seems that way sometimes, even though there's an explosion of spirituality nowadays. But over time, we just get further and further from God, and oh, God has lost control. He can't be all powerful, because if he were, he would stop all of this. He would stop it right now. This is specious reasoning. We talked about specious reasoning a few weeks ago in logic, the idea of presenting an argument that sounds good. Because others might think, yeah, that's right. If God is so powerful and all, he could stop evil right now and save everybody. Why don't you do it? Yeah, yeah. No, it's a stupid argument, okay? Stupid because when you make that argument, you're ignoring the very evidence of the Bible itself, which I'll talk about now. And so, if it's true, then why doesn't God end it all right now? That came up, of course, in 2 Peter, where's my passage here? In 2 Peter 3:9, that question that people ask today has, again, like everything else, nothing new under the sun, was raised then. In 2 Peter 3:9, when Peter's talking about the second coming of Christ, there'll be a final destruction of the whole universe and all things will be brought to complete fruition and consummation in Jesus Christ. The critics were saying the same thing to Peter. Where is Jesus? Where is the promise that has come? How come he hasn't come? Well, you know, either he's going to come back next week or next month. And of course, they're measuring time by their own standard. And of course, as we know with God, time is irrelevant. But Peter says to their, here's his response, the same one you can give to somebody who asks the same question. It is, and this is the New English Bible, it is not that the Lord is slow or forgetful in fulfilling his promise. God is not slow, dim-witted, like he's lost control. He knows exactly what's going on. And he says, as some suppose. Some suppose God is slow, God is impotent, he doesn't have the power to do it, so they're laughing and laughing. But that he is very patient with you, because it is not his will for any to be lost, but for all to come to repentance. What Peter basically is saying is the world goes on and on, not because of sin's reign, but because of the reign of righteousness. That God is simply waiting and waiting and waiting for more people to come to repentance. Even the very critics who would raise this question, Peter would say, he's waiting for you to come forward. He's waiting for all of us. And by all, I mean we're all sinners. So whether we've obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ and still sin, or whether we've never obeyed it, he's waiting for all of us to make our lives right with God. And when that time comes, he's decided that, you know, that's it. I've allowed, and he will end it all. And I was thinking about this as I was putting it down here, and I thought, think of it this way, to make it more practical. Based on the demographics of the world, people who you know measure world populations, there are about 370,000 people born every day on this planet. That's an awesome number, 370,000 people. Now, of that number, many of them, sadly, will not obey the Lord. If they live to be 70, 80 years old, they will not obey. That's just a fact. Many of them will choose not to obey the Lord, but that's the free will that God gave them. However, think about this. Of that same number, many others will follow the Lord. Like Joshua 24:15, where Joshua says that me and my house, we will obey the Lord. Or you can go do what you want. There will be those who will go back and obey the pagan gods in Joshua's day. And he says, okay, that's your choice. Me and my family, we're going to obey the Lord. Think of it that way. So God offers salvation to all, and he is so patient waiting for us to respond. And of course, I mentioned earlier, you have to bear this in mind. When men speak about God, they speak about God in terms of our limitation. We are finite creatures who live in a temporal world, that is a world based on time, the calendar and the clock. God has no concern about time because he's infinite. So it's totally irrelevant to him. So there's our first mistake. We think, oh, time's going on and on, a couple of weeks, a couple of years, a couple of millennia, doesn't matter to God. Time goes on as long as he wants it to go on. And he's waiting and waiting for us. And consider this one final fact. Consider kind of the converse of the 370. I also found out there are about 150,000 people on our orb, our planet, who die every day around the world. So obviously we're growing in population. But of the 150,000 people who die each day, of that number, of that vast number, certain ones will die in their faith. Hebrews 11:13. Of that number of the 150,000, and whether it's 10 or 15 or 5, like in the days of Lot, you know, where can I find 5 or 10 people who will obey? Doesn't matter. Of that number of people who die, there are those that will go on to obey the Lord and go on to heaven. And so think of it that way. It's the idea of parents that I've heard adults often say, I don't want to have kids because it's such a horrible, sinful world and they might go wrong. Yeah, but they also might grow up to be gospel preachers or elders in a church or great, you know, women, you know, as Christians. So the idea is that God, when he gave us free will, he also gave the possibility that there'll be those who not obey him, and there's those who will. So think of it both ways, that God lets time go on and on, waiting for us to respond. And whenever that time comes, when God's given us enough of our time, he will then send forth his son to bring about the end. And let me hasten on here. And the really comforting thing, too, is to me, one of the most comforting verses in the Bible about death is Psalms 116:15. Sometimes when I've given eulogies at memorials or funerals in the past, I always like to use this verse where we're told that precious in the sight of God is the death of his saints. Death is... Okay. Okay, so bear that in mind. Okay, I'm going to skip this page here. This is just a review. This has been a contextual study of the historical, political, religious, cultural, and moral conditions into which not only Christ was born, but where the apostles lived, labored, and died. I'm not going to go over all these. Don't worry about that. But in your booklet for this class, of which we are out, I know, these are the topics we covered, so you can kind of scan them very quickly and see what we've tried to cover. Every one of these topics is a particular component of culture, what makes a culture a culture. We've looked at all of these in some kind of detail, and I think I'm going to make it, okay? My last page. My final words, if I can put it all together the way I would like. If we learn nothing else from history, from a study of history, we clearly see that while times change, people do not. We've talked about this. Human nature during the days of Moses and Socrates, Shakespeare, Lincoln, Einstein, down to the parade of history and others, follow the same course. Shakespeare was no different than we are today. The people about whom he wrote in his plays based on real individuals, they're no different from us. We're all the same all the way through. We're the same, maybe technology changes, maybe certain fashions change, but the will in which God created us, the intellect, conscience, emotion, and volition, that is will that God gave us, that doesn't change all the way through history. Nothing of that has ever changed. Second point. That said, we still gain much about the past by studying the cultures of societies. You might say, Jack, if we're all the same, why, you know, because we learn from the past. And you can't learn from the past if you don't study it, obviously. So we go back and look at ancient cultures and see that the people were the same, but there were certain conditions that were different, which we studied in this class the last few months, over those millennia. And so it's particularly helpful we can go back and study, because we in modern times can examine those of ancient times to understand them and to learn from them. And my final point as we conclude this class is this. Our God, who transcends time and space, he made time and space, the space-time continuum, as Einstein would call it. He has made all of us and everything in it. Has disclosed his will by revelation. He's given us his will. When he didn't leave us, you know, on our own. He gave us that will. In Acts 20 and verse 27, Paul refers to the counsel of God. That word counsel there comes from a Greek word that means all the contents of the divine plan. There's been a plan with God from the very beginning, from before the beginning, in all the future. And that plan came forth in creation, it came forth in the resurrection, it still comes forth in God's providence. And so that will is being carried out. And as that divine plan was set into action in human history, the creation, and when Jesus came, Galatians 4:4, as human history was going on, God intervened into history, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, who came as the Son of God on earth. Our Creator determined the opportune moment, the exact moment, when he would enter history with the Savior, his son, and his message, which is the gospel. That was the fullness of times, which Paul's talking about in Galatians 4:4. Our world then received the full measure of God's grace and mercy in that moment with the advent of Jesus Christ, for which ever since we have been the fortunate recipients. Thank you very much for your kind and polite attention these last 3 months.